Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
The only things certain in life are death and taxes, or so said Benjamin Franklin. We won't be dealing with death today, so that leaves taxes. And with the dreaded April 15th deadline fast approaching, many of us are thinking about ways we could, or should, have minimized our tax liabilities in the previous year. One of the most common ways to do so has been through charitable giving, which includes making contributions to various secular or religious organizations that are officially registered as charities with the government. While many of us last-minute filers are scrambling through our charitable accounts looking for any slight tax advantage we can muster, I thought it'd be a worthwhile study to examine the larger issue of religious charity, including large philanthropic gifts, and how changes in the tax code can affect how money flows to churches and their associated activities. This isn't merely an issue of self-interest when it comes to filing taxes. There are some very profound questions about how we, as a society, use our resources to make the world a better place. One of the most fundamental questions that we must address, particularly in a world where state and federal budgets are bursting at the seams, is whether many social ills are best addressed by government or by private citizens working through charitable organizations, not the least of which include the hundreds of thousands of churches and other religious groups that provide for our spiritual, psychological, and material needs. To help me wade through the world of charity, philanthropy, and, taxes, I'm pleased to be joined today by Mr. David Wills. David is the president of the National Christian Foundation, a position he has held since 1998. He is also a practicing lawyer specializing in charitable gift and estate planning, tax-exempt organizations, and many other fiduciary matters. He holds degrees from Baylor University and the Dallas Theological Seminary, and is the co-author of two books, Investing in God's Business and Family.Money. We'll link to those two books on our website, so please be sure to visit. David also sits on the boards of various charitable organizations, including Generous Giving, Hope for the Heart, and the Evangelical Council for Financial Accountability. David, welcome to Research on Religion.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me, sir.
Okay, first things first. Are you finished filing your taxes this year?
Absolutely not.
Oh!
I kind of have a personal deal that I refuse to file my taxes until we reach Tax Freedom Day.
Ah, and when is that day?
Well, we don't find that out till the end of the first quarter. Last year, it was the, I think, the 10th of April. This year it should be a little bit longer. You know, Tax Freedom Day is the day where you officially stop paying federal, state, and local taxes, and you actually start to keep what you've earned.
Yeah. Now, you're down in Georgia. Are the taxes there a little bit higher than other places in the United States?
That's a great question. Georgia is an average state as far as the Tax Freedom Day.
Mm-hmm.
If you live in Connecticut, New York, or New Jersey, you've got about 3 more weeks of paying.
Ooh.
Compared to Georgia. And, of course, those of you that are listening from Alaska, you win the prize. You have the shortest duration. So congratulations, Sarah Palin. Alaska is the best state to live in. Your tax obligation ends more quickly than any other state in the union.
Yeah, well, I was going to have you fill out my taxes, but since you're still working on yours, I think I better get to it. April 10th, Tax Freedom Day, April 15th, regular filing day. So that I've always thought that's kind of curious, though, that April 15th is almost exactly 6 months opposite of our federal elections that occur in the first Tuesday of November.
I kind of doubt that's a coincidence.
I know. They should move them back. They're a little bit closer so we can have a little bit of better idea of what we are voting on here.
We're sure a lot better than the UK. Their Tax Freedom Day this year probably will be in June.
Ouch. Well, let's hope we're not heading off in that direction yet.
So that might be an indication for anybody that's listening that that may not be the best economic system for us to move toward.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Well, let me go ahead and start off here with a philosophical issue and get your thoughts on things. And that deals as well with how government uses our tax dollars. So it's very apropos to what we were just talking about here in terms of Tax Freedom Day, of how much money we give to the government or how much work we do for the government relative to us. But over the last century or so, and largely since the progressive era in the early 1900s, there's been a tendency in our nation and around the world, specifically in Europe, to assign government a greater role in managing a wider range of social needs and problems. Things such as worrying about education, poverty, mental health counseling, medical care, et cetera, et cetera. And there seems to be an ongoing debate as to whether many of these activities should best be left to local non-governmental communities, such as churches, religious groups, or secular charities. Or should this be the proper purview of the federal government? Given that you work in the area of charitable contributions, what are your thoughts on the role of private charities relative to government action in dealing with various social issues?
Well, that's a multifaceted question. I guess the shortest answer to that question would be Katrina.
Mm-hmm.
Is one of the most recent examples that we can look very clearly to see whether or not it's wise for government to be in charge of dealing with the society's difficulties, or whether or not charitable organizations should do so. In fact, there's been quite a bit of writing back when all that happened of just about how much more effective the non-governmental organizations were doing the exact same things that the government was trying to do. Yeah, I guess another question to ask, just to take it any further, is there any way we can look to see whether or not when the government gets involved, it actually gets worse mm-hmm. as opposed to better?
Well, let me stop you before we get in there more broadly. Let's talk about the issue of Katrina. What is it about Katrina? Now, we know that the federal government, FEMA, was pretty much an utter disaster there. And having lived in California and gone through a number of earthquakes, include the Northridge earthquake, I've learned quickly to never count on FEMA for rapid response. But what about the charitable community? How'd they respond?
Well, the charitable community always responds effectively relative to government. I mean, right now, even in Japan, for example, the most effective work that's being done over there is probably being done by charitable organizations.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is because there is a tremendous amount of a number of charitable organizations whose core functionality is built around handling things like Katrina. That's what they do day in and day out. That is not the typical role for our government. It's not a core functionality.
Right.
And therefore, when they start to get into it, inherently it becomes a difficult thing. Really, the only exception to that rule that we see, and we usually see it internationally, for some reason, it doesn't work as well inside the United States, probably primarily because of FEMA's typical ineptness, is that when our military is involved in disaster relief, that actually can be fairly effective. And one of the reasons it is because of the assets that our military has to help. So, for example, in Japan, you see that there are scenarios where the government can help in societal issues, but it's very limited to where they do it effectively. So all of the relief efforts that happened that were probably done effectively in the Katrina environment were done by NGOs, by both secular and religious nonprofit organizations. That's what they do.
Yeah.
They're experts at it.
You make a really good point with that, too. I've often said to a number of my students that whenever there is a natural disaster around the world, the first responders are always the U.S. Marines, and the second are usually Christian missionaries.
That's right.
And as you mentioned, that the U.S. military just has the logistical ability to do that. One, they're ready for rapid response. They have the boats, the airplanes, the equipment to take care of that. But, yeah, not too far back on their footsteps, you do see the Christian missionaries here. So that's in terms of disaster response. And you're making, a good case for non-governmental organizations being ready to really move into natural disasters and such. But what about other areas that might not be natural disasters, such as educational activities, helping the homeless, et cetera, et cetera?
I think the same theory applies
mm-hmm.
in both scenarios. Again, it's our government is it's an enterprise. It functions like an enterprise, and its core functionality is typically not to do many of those things that are handled very effectively by non-government organizations. So when it gets outside of that purview, I mean, the questions are, first of all, who knows best how to meet these needs? Who's got the intelligence? Who understands it? Basically, kind of who understands the customer, if you will, those that are in need, and then who most effectively can meet those needs? And then an even better question to ask is, in comparing the government with the NGO environment, the tax-exempt world, who is better at creating lasting or sustainable change or help? In other words, is one of them more likely to just deal with a symptom versus the disease? And the answer to that question is yes. Our government, at best, deals with symptoms. They come in, they go out. And so the underlying issues don't get dealt with. And that's why, when you go into to solve any need, any societal need, there isn't a fixed sum of problems. There's not 2 million problems and we're whittling them away every day and eventually it'll be zero.
Right.
It just doesn't work that way. And so actually you can create more problems when solving a single problem.
Mm-hmm.
Or in solving a problem, you actually can solve future potential problems. You can go in both directions.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very dynamic situation, but what you want when dealing with societal needs is you want people that are in there. And in answering those three questions that I asked you a second ago about, understanding who has the need and how to deal with it in a sustainable manner, well, you want folks that can go in and not only solve the immediate problem, but also create an environment where future problems aren't fostered. And that is just not historically the role of our government. And as you mentioned, with regards to the progressive era, that's the thing that's changing. Our government has decided that it wants to be more and more involved in that. And, it just traditionally doesn't do a great job there.
Yeah, one can also understand the political system as well when you mentioned about talking about treating symptoms of various social ills. Our political system in many ways is set up for that quick fix because an election is coming up in 2 years or in 4 years or in 6 years. And so you go, if you throw a bunch of money at a problem, do a ribbon cutting ceremony and say, oh, here's a new food bank, problem solved. But in reality, you might not be doing that. These other organizations, these secular and religious NGOs, actually have more at stake in making sure that the problem is taken care of in the long run.
Yeah, several years ago, I met with a U.S. senator in Washington in his office, and I asked him what he thought was the factor of effectiveness, charity versus government. Which one is more effective? And I knew that he thought that charity was more effective than government. So I said, what do you think, 10 times more effective? Is charity 10 times more effective? And he said, maybe 20. And interestingly enough, kind of mirroring this issue to your earlier introduction with regards to tax-related issues, if that's true, let's just say that I was right. It's 10 times more effective in certain areas. And he's probably right in some areas it may be 20 times more effective. Well, now all of a sudden, the charitable income tax deduction is a phenomenal deal for our government if they will allow where the charitable giving goes to tackle those issues.
Mm-hmm.
It's a huge win for them if the effectiveness is that much greater, because they're pretty much chipping in 25 cents on the dollar.
Right. Very inefficient.
So if the government would spend the 25 cents to further something that's 10 or 20 times more effective than if they spent a dollar doing it,
mm-hmm.
That's a huge win for the government.
Yeah.
But because they continue to plow into these areas where they're ineffective, costs go up, and now you're probably going to talk to me about this, that the deduction itself could be in jeopardy.
Yeah, we're going to cover that because I did have the opportunity to talk with you a couple months back, and you had mentioned some things about the tax code that might be changing that are somewhat frightening, to say the least. We'll get to that in a second, so we're going to ask our listeners to hang in there. But I want to talk a little bit about what role your organization does in facilitating the use of private funds to charities here. Now, you're the president of the National Christian Foundation. Mm-hmm. What kind of things do you do in terms of directing money here, there, and everywhere?
Well, we're a grant-making charity. And so we make lots of grants. Actually, last year we made tens of thousands of grants. We essentially serve probably about 7,000 to 8,000 families around the country, and we help them facilitate their giving.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the ways that we do that is in the grant making process. So last year we probably made grants to maybe close to 10,000 different organizations, about $400 million of grants. And so, needless to say, that we're funding a lot of these organizations. And it's not only Christian organizations that we fund. I mean, we will fund the American Red Cross. We will fund the Boy Scouts of America and other entities. What we don't do is we don't fund things that we consider to be antithetical to the historical Christian faith.
Mm-hmm. Now, how does that work? Let's say I'm a person who has a lot of money. I want to do some goodwill with it, and I'm not sure what to do. I call your office, and what happens?
Well, first of all, you would be quite an anomaly.
Okay.
If you are someone who has more money than you know what to do with it, that would be an extraordinary set of circumstances. Clearly, in our experience, there are far more needs that a giver is aware of than they can fund. So it's as you could imagine, just open up your mailbox, and there's a lot more needs out there than most people can fund. So it's a very rare question that someone calls and says, you know, I've got X number of dollars to give away and have no idea where it ought to go. That's just an extremely rare kind of a phone call.
So how do you do that? How do you match donors with donation organizations?
Well, the donors themselves advise us where they want the funds to be granted.
I see. Okay.
In most cases, we have different types of tools that donors use based upon their needs and their particular situation.
Mm-hmm.
And so the donor, we're very involved. The donors effectively help us determine where we should make our grants.
Okay. I see how that works. And are there specific areas or organizations that tend to be favored more than others that you work with?
Well, there are certain types of charitable organizations that are more likely to be funded. I mean, keep in mind we're the National Christian Foundation. And so, as you could well imagine, the lion's share of our funding goes to very overt Christian type environments and type entities. As you could imagine, in serving Christians, as far as volume goes, a lot of churches receive grants from us.
Okay. These just local churches that have some need, right?
Yeah, most folks that we serve are probably faithful church attenders, mm-hmm. in all likelihood. And so they're likely to pick their church as a recipient. But, there are a lot of different types of organizations that were involved in funding. And, most of them fit within the category of basically advancing God's kingdom, his redemptive and restorative purposes.
Mm-hmm.
And so, we're going to fund things that are in the evangelism environment, the mercy environment, the things that we kind of talk, a lot of those social situations, a lot of things that have to do with discipleship and basically spiritual flourishing, if you will. Justice issues are very big in the space right now.
Would it be possible to give an example of a justice issue?
Well, yeah, probably the most common funded justice issue. Well, definitely human trafficking is one of the biggest things that people are really going after right now. It's I would say it's one of the key areas that is really being targeted from a giving standpoint to essentially try to rid our world of human trafficking and human slavery.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very big thing right now in the giving community. But we also fund, culture impacting things, the family, for example, and those kinds of things, and arts, all those kind of culturally impacting things, and then the foundational kind of things, the undergirding, the supporting type of functions from, brick and mortar type things as well. So really, every sphere of the giving environment, we will fund it. Is that answering your question?
It does. And there's another question that when I was listening to popped into my head, that you had mentioned that a donor will come to you and they want to give money to their church, and so they're working through you. My big question is, well, why don't they just give it to the church? I'm thinking of myself, Sunday morning, collection plate comes around, you know, drop a 50 in there, and yeah. I'm good for the week. Why couldn't I just go directly to the church? What does your organization provide that would allow me as a donor to facilitate funds to my church?
Well, you know, for some people, using the services that we have, it may not make sense for everybody. But, I mean, I can just tell you personally, my own personal experience, and you and I are probably somewhat similarly situated from a financial standpoint. I actually started using NCF several years before I went to work for NCF. And I'll tell you, initially there were two main reasons that my wife and I used NCF. First of all, we gave to quite a few numbers of like people that we supported in ministries and quite a few organizations that we supported. Probably, you know, I'm guessing that when we started using NCF, we were probably given to at least 8, maybe 10 different organizations.
Mm-hmm.
And so using NCF just made it easier, you know, kind of like automatic bill pay, electronic bill pay. You know, we gave into one account, and then we just, you click and give. So it was just simple. Speaking of, you know, doing your taxes, I mean, I have one receipt. I have one charitable organization that I will turn in my receipts for, and it's because we do all of our giving into our fund, and then out of our fund, it goes to lots of different places.
So oh, I see how that works. Yeah. That's very clever. I hadn't thought about that because my wife last weekend was dealing with a whole kitchen table full of receipts of
yep.
you know, where we got this and having to punch it into the calculator and put it into our spreadsheet and stuff. So I can see where that eases things quite
a bit. Another reason that we use it is we do a lot of our giving anonymously. And we've done that you know, since we got married, you know, almost 20 years ago. And it's virtually impossible to do that without some kind of an intermediary. And so you can do it with cash anonymously, but that gets to be kind of a hassle sending cash through the mail
right.
without a return address. A little risky to do that. We actually used to do that. And now, because we use NCF, we just check the box anonymous, and the people that are receiving it have a foggy idea where it's coming from.
Do a lot of your clients make use of that anonymous giving checkbox?
No, not all of them, but I would say a growing number of them do.
That's interesting.
Yeah. And then I'd say probably quite a few years ago, we actually gave away some real estate that we owned to the National Christian Foundation, and then when it liquidated, we distributed I think we probably distributed to 4 or 5 different organizations.
Okay.
As opposed to doing a 20% deed to, you know, 5 different organizations. We just gave it to one place, and when it sold, we went online and distributed it out. I mean, and I could give you many more reasons. Those are 3 ones that have been very helpful for us. Mm-hmm. We also sometimes get to the end of the year and know how much we should give. From a tax standpoint, but we don't know exactly where we think it ought to go.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we just drop it into our NCF fund, and then, you know, in January, or in the first quarter, I should say, we actually do most of our personal grant making in the first quarter of the year.
Oh, that's interesting.
So, I mean, those are some reasons. Are you tracking with me?
No, I am, and it's a really interesting story to know that you were a satisfied customer who then became the president of the organization. Those are always wonderful stories in business that you hear quite a bit about. Actually, let me ask you a little bit more about this, too, because I'm not as familiar with your organization as I perhaps should be, but me, I'm a kind of a small change kind of charitable giver, and when I tend to think of organizations like NCF or other organizations like that, I tend to think of big philanthropic gifts. And I'm wondering, what is the difference between small-time charity, big-time philanthropic gifts? Is there a different dynamic that you work with or that you see in that world?
I'm not sure I understand your question, but are you asking, you know, is there a difference between when you just think of giving to charity versus doing philanthropy?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I mean, that's just a nomenclature issue, really. I mean, charity is just helping those in need. I guess most people, when they think of charity, probably think potentially maybe more on the spectrum of the widow and the mite. And people, when they think of philanthropy, probably think more on the spectrum of, you know, Gates and Buffett.
Right.
Most people, I guess, would say that one of them is probably more reactive. Charity is more reactive. You see a need, you meet it.
Mm-hmm.
Philanthropy is probably seen as maybe like foundations and proactive and thinking through things real carefully and making lots of decisions.
And perhaps building a legacy or something.
Perhaps building a legacy. Yeah. So, you know, those are, you know, connotations, if you will, but that's probably generally how that's seen.
Mm-hmm.
We serve both. We have, you know, people that, you know, might give away as little as $5,000 to $10,000 a year, and we serve people that give away tens of millions of dollars a year.
Yeah. That's really interesting. I hadn't really thought about that of the wide range of donors that you have there. But as you described your organization, it really does make a lot of sense that you facilitate the needs for a number of different individuals. And it's a pretty neat entrepreneurial service that is being offered, which is one of the reasons I like the free marketplace. There's always somebody there coming up with a new idea of how to make things easier and to facilitate these things for individuals.
Absolutely, and we're constantly trying to innovate.
That's really neat.
So,
well, let me go ahead and bring it back to this issue of government versus the charitable world. And in an earlier podcast that I did with economist Dan Hungerman at Notre Dame, we discussed how government policy and taxation can oftentimes crowd out charitable or philanthropic giving, I guess the wide range that we just talked about here. Do you find this to be a challenge with your donors? I'm thinking about myself when there was talk about the tax rates, the Bush tax cuts not being extended at the end of this year. I was thinking, oh, man, you know, this could be a couple thousand more dollars off, you know, my gross at the end of the year. I don't know if I can give this to charity or not. Do people really tend to worry about that?
I would say that the folks that we serve, probably not as much as you would think the global giving audience would. And I'm kind of answering the question that, you know, does government's engagement potentially affect people's giving? In other words, if government's taking care of that, do we need to give to it?
Yeah, there's two dimensions of this. One is I'm thinking about giving to a homeless charity. But the government just recently moved in with some new homeless initiative, so I don't need to worry about that. And as you mentioned before, what the government might be doing might be drastically more inefficient than what Gospel Union Mission or some other type of charitable group might be doing. So that's one aspect of it. But the other aspect is if tax rates go up and more of my annual paycheck gets taken out for taxes, I might be less willing to put in an extra 5 or 10 in the collection plate.
Yeah, those are two different issues that you're talking about in that question. You know, the first one is, does the fact that the government is meeting some societal needs impact the charitable giving of individuals? And the next question is the incentive of tax benefits relevant to what people give?
Right.
Okay, let's take the first question. And the first question, and I don't want to be too pejorative here, but most of the folks that we serve don't enjoy paying taxes.
Yeah.
They would really rather minimize their taxation. One of the reasons is because they think that government is extremely inefficient in what they do. So it may very well be that if the government tried to go in and tried to meet a need that a Christian environment is trying to meet, it may very well increase the giving to the Christian environment.
Really?
Because people don't think the government does things effectively. And so, and again, I'm talking about a very defined group of people who think that, for example, that when you're meeting the needs of the poor, like you gave the example of the homeless ministry, that the spiritual aspect of what that ministry is doing is the most important thing that happens in meeting that societal need. And so In other words, it goes back to the issue of, do you treat the disease or you treat the symptom?
Mm-hmm.
And most people will say in situations like what you just described, homelessness, well, there's a lot more to homelessness than just someone not having a home.
Mm-hmm.
There are basic spiritual needs, maybe psychological needs that they have that can't be met by a bed. And so it's the issue of treating the whole person. And in Christian ministry, it's very common in those environments to treat the whole person. In the government environment, almost by definition, they will not do that.
Right.
They just won't, and they shouldn't. Mm-hmm. And so I would say in the world in which I work, people don't get confused and say, oh, well, if the government's taking care of that societal need, then I don't need to be involved in giving to it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they see it that way. That's just from my optics. Now, does that answer that question before I move to the next one you mentioned?
It does, and it provides a really interesting spin on the work that Hungerman has done that has seen some of a crowding out effect, and some of the research that I have done as well, where social welfare states tend to push out the traditional role of churches, and churches are seen as less relevant nowadays. But you know, it's heartening to hear from your end of this issue that people aren't really necessarily thinking that way.
Well, I certainly don't. Now, again, you're talking about the act of giving versus the reality of what needs can be met and how they can be met.
Yeah.
My guess is in the areas where giving would go down because of something the government's doing, that's probably more in a secular vein of giving, would be my guess.
It could be, yeah.
And that would make sense to me. If the only reason that I wanted to give to a homeless shelter was to provide a bed,
mm-hmm.
and the government's doing it already, I could clearly see where I would not see a purpose in doing that. Why would I give of my money when I'm already giving the government my tax money? I certainly can see a correlation there.
Yeah, I'm tending to think of the work done by Arthur Brooks on charitable giving. He's found out that people who are highly religious tend to be the best givers, and people who are religiously conservative tend to be the highest. Religious liberals tend to fall next on that chain. What is interesting, and I've had conversations with some of my secular colleagues around the country, and they've often told me, well, I don't give to charity because I'd just rather give it to taxes. And so I can see what you're saying here is that if the government moves into an area, people who tend to be much more secular say, ah, I'm already giving to that charity every April 15th.
Sir, absolutely right.
Yeah.
Yep, that's exactly what I'm trying to communicate. I may not have said it very well, but that's what I'm trying to communicate.
Yeah, let's move into the issue of taxation and talking about our current federal tax code, which allows individuals to deduct a portion of their charitable giving each year on their income taxes.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give us a little bit of background on this tax code and perhaps how it's changed over the years? And I know there's some changes that are in the offing here. We'll hold that off for a second. But if you could do a little bit of retrospective analysis for us of how things have changed in that area.
Well, I think that, I guess from a historical standpoint, I'll just speak to the charitable income tax deduction. I think that's what you're really talking about.
Right.
Is that correct?
Yeah, that's a good place to focus on, sure.
Yeah, you know, when that came into existence, you know, our government, it was pre-progressive, the progressive environment that you mentioned earlier in your question.
Mm-hmm.
Our government was very intentional about thinking that the role of charity and even religious charity in our culture was extremely important for meeting societal needs. It was very overt. The viewpoint that people have today about religious charity meeting societal needs, that is not something that was around significantly back when the income tax charitable income tax deduction was instituted, because the reason it was instituted was because almost the opposite of what you're seeing today. Our government thought that it's more wise to incent people to give to even churches and charities to meet these societal needs because they do it better than we do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you've read the writings of de Tocqueville, and when he saw what was happening here like that, this extraordinary philanthropic freedom that existed, this liberty, if you will, that our government encouraged, and our people, you know, voluntarily were just giving to meet all these societal needs, he was amazed at that. He'd never seen anything like that before. And I certainly hope that the next guy that comes over from France that looks at us does, you know, I wish that they could still see that.
Yeah.
But it's getting crowded out. So the history of the charitable income tax deduction, unashamedly, was to serve as an incentive to, you know, so that the charitable organizations could relieve the burden of government. So issues, for example, like housing and caring for the poor, those were handled by religious organizations and charitable organizations.
Mm-hmm.
And the bottom line is they also, and you'll notice in the tax code that if you're a church, you don't even have to file a Form 1023 to get tax-exempt status.
Hmm.
And that's how far it went. In other words, churches are automatically tax-exempt if they're a church. And one of the reasons for that is because our government at one point thought that just the existence of churches was positive for the culture that we lived in.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in other words, that's a wise thing for the government to want to encourage in our culture, was people being religious, so to speak, because people that were religious behaved. You know, it was a culturally positive thing.
You know, one of the things I like about that approach, too, and before we start talking about the changes that have occurred throughout history, but the thing that I like about that approach is that it allows millions of individuals to have their say in what they think the most important need is in society, rather than leaving it to some bureau in Washington, D.C., or in Atlanta, Georgia, or Olympia, Washington. And in that regard, too, I think the organizations, the churches, and that really have to think hard about what are the social needs and how can we engage individuals in becoming part of this part of the solution of solving social problems here.
Yes, what you're talking about is the reality of subsidiarity.
Mm-hmm.
That the best people to solve a local problem are local people.
Yeah.
It's just a reality. And so it's very difficult for Washington to understand how to help people in the Fifth Ward of New Orleans.
Right.
They're not good at that.
Right.
You know who's good at that? Churches that are in that part of New Orleans.
Right.
They're very good at that. And other ministries, but not just necessarily even churches, even just charitable organizations that's what they do and that's where they are.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to be more effective. And historically, our government has said that is a wise thing, and therefore, we're going to basically say to people, look, if you want to give to these types of organizations, we're not going to make you pay income tax on that money.
Right.
And that's what the charitable income tax deduction is.
Now, you'd mentioned that early on in our history, it is really to encourage church-based organizations. When does this start changing?
When did this start changing?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's a very vague historical process that's going here. But, you know, as you mentioned, the 1800s or the early 1900s, there's this desire by government to really engage churches. Churches and other charitable organizations, go out there and do your thing, and we're going to give you the means to do that. But it doesn't seem to be the case now. And we were just talking a minute earlier that we view religious charities today much differently than we may have in the past, whereas in the past, they were a core feature of our society. Now it seems to be icing on top of the cake of what the government is doing. The government is the big cake that solves all our problems. And, oh, we'll give to religious charities to help out. Is that kind of what has happened over the course of the 20th century?
Well, I think that is correct. One of your earlier questions alluded to that when you said that, you know, since the progressive era began, government has more and more encroached into those areas. Now, I do think that, as the code describes, houses of worship, with regards to the charitable environment that's going to be restricted over time, and we can talk about that if you want,
mm-hmm.
Churches are likely to be the last one standing. And our country just traditionally has placed a high value on religious churches, synagogues, mosques, any house of worship, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
There's a high bar there for our government to undermine that in our culture. But we're moving in that direction.
Well, let's talk about that now. Let's talk about changes in the tax code that are possibly on the horizon here. And when I had an opportunity to meet with you a few months ago, you had mentioned these to me, and it somewhat took me by surprise. I hadn't heard much about this in the news, and the extent of the changes is somewhat frightening, I guess. So what's on the horizon?
Well, I don't know if you've noticed, but our government's capacity to spend money is rapidly increasing.
No, I hadn't noticed that.
Yeah, it is so out of control that, during this phone call, our government will spend, in all likelihood, well over $400 million.
Yeesh.
Okay? And so that means, for example, when people pay the estate tax, which has now been reinstituted, that it just doesn't take the government very long to spend that tax money. So you may have worked for 40 years to accumulate wealth, and 35% of it will evaporate literally in seconds for most people. And therefore, our government's spending is out of control. And therefore, our government has got to look for revenue, because so far they've been unable to curb the appetite of spending.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we've hit the wall. Maybe politically we're going to see that change. The things we're hearing today, we've heard before. Let's hope that this time it happens. But until it does, our government is going to look for places for revenue. And the charitable area is fairly low-hanging fruit. It's not a small number. Hundreds of billions of dollars would be saved by making changes to either exempt status or the charitable income tax deduction. By the way, those are the two different potential ways that that could be altered. The government can redefine what is exempt.
Right.
Or the government can redefine what is deductible. Or they can do both of those things if they want to.
Currently, right now, let me just ask this question, because my wife normally handles our taxes. What percentage of my charitable giving, and specifically to religious organizations, can I write off on my income taxes?
If you give cash,
mm-hmm.
let's say that if you have an adjusted gross income of $100,000, you can take a charitable income tax deduction, typically for up to 50% of your adjusted gross income. If you give what are called long-term capital gain assets, stock, for example, that you've held for more than a year that's appreciated, and let's say that you do your giving that way, you can deduct up to 30% of your adjusted gross income with those. And so it's not inconsequential if
right,
you are extremely charitable.
It's much higher than I would have anticipated.
Beg your pardon?
It's much higher than I would have anticipated.
Well, I'll tell you what with the folks that we work with, we say, and we often work with people that have higher incomes than what I just described. The bottom line is it's somewhat like a government matching program. If you don't use up that 50%, it's gone forever.
Right.
And so we encourage folks, especially that have, multiple sources of income that may or may not be taxable, max out that 50%, because essentially what the government does is it's depending upon your average tax rate, it could be 25, it could be 35, maybe at some point in the near future, 40% of a break. And it's great. I mean, it's fantastic that the government gives that incentive. And again, all they're doing is they're saying you don't have to pay income tax. This isn't a tax credit. This is a tax deduction. So if you give away that $50,000, they're just saying you don't have to pay income tax on that, effectively.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so it's not like a money-making deal. You can't make money by giving money away. So, for example, when the president, in his third budget, is trying to cap the charitable income tax deduction at 28%, for example,
mm-hmm.
essentially he's saying that people that have a tax rate higher than that, they're going to have to pay income tax on money they give away. In other words, it's going to cost you, out of pocket, more than the gift that you make.
Yeah, and that'll be a huge disincentive to give.
Well, sure. I mean, people that are giving at that level, that are going to bump up against that, they're often relatively well-planned.
Mm-hmm.
They're thinking through these things, and so they're going to find ways to make the best use of the tax code they can. What the charitable income tax deduction, it doesn't determine whether or not someone gives, but it does determine for a fairly significant group of people how much they give.
Yeah.
And so when the government, when the, I think it's CBO that and analyzes how much money is saved or spent on tax policy. You know, when they put that out there and they say we want to cap it at 28%, well, they come back and say, well, that's going to generate X number hundreds of billions of revenue over the next 9 or 10 years.
Right.
Well, if it's generating that much revenue, well, that means that less giving is going to happen.
Right.
Or the revenue wouldn't be generated.
Absolutely.
So it's not inconsequential. It's a fairly big number. And it's unfortunate that the government's going to, that at least so far, each time that budget item has come up in the president's budget, it's basically been dismissed on arrival.
Okay, that's what I wanted to ask, of how is this being accepted in Congress, because the Obama administration can propose it, but it does have to be passed through our national legislature. And I would say 2 years ago, back in 2009, things might have been much different than they are today after the 2010 election. So what is the political climate now? Is it really, this is not a go item to cap it at 28%?
Yeah, every year that goes by where our deficit gets bigger and our capacity to spend gets greater, the need for revenue will also get greater.
Mm-hmm.
And every time that happens, there will be more and more people that will see this as a reasonable alternative.
And it might not even be down to the 28%. One could say, well, let's just compromise at 34% or then 33%.
Well, actually, what happens is that really the only people that this would affect would be major donors.
Okay.
So it's a very easy sell to say, you know, this is just we're just not giving the rich as big of a tax break. There is a line of thinking that crosses party lines in Washington. This is not necessarily a Democrat-Republican issue here. You have to remember that, in my experience, it's actually those that are on the ends of the spectrum. The most liberal people in Washington are often very pro-charity.
Mm-hmm.
And the most conservative people are very pro-charity. And the reason is because they both have different kinds of charities that they really think are important.
Right.
And so that's actually a good thing for us. But there's, all across the spectrum, it's very common for people in Washington to refer to the charitable income tax deduction as a subsidy for the wealthy. Now, if you know the definition of a subsidy, you know that doesn't make any sense at all.
Right, and that's what you were talking about
but
earlier.
In their mindset, that's the way they see it. It's money that the government could be collecting that they're not, and therefore it's a subsidy. And that mindset is growing. There's no question it's growing. How long do we have? I don't know. But certainly we have a president today who is unashamedly coming out and saying, we need to do something about this.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to put it in black and white in front of everybody. And he's done it 3 times in a row. And he'll do it again the 4th time. Mm-hmm. Every time he does it for a different reason. You know, the first time he did it because he wanted to pay for health care with it. The second time that he did it because he wanted to allegedly lower the deficit with that money. This time he did it because he also wants to make some changes with the AMT tax problem that's catching more and more middle class people.
Yeah.
So you can see he's becoming more and more strategic every time he does it.
Yeah. Now
that's one side of the coin.
Now, yes, that's what I was going to say. That deals with the tax rate, but there was something else that you had mentioned before, is defining what constitutes a charitable organization. What is happening on that front?
Yeah, that's a whole other issue, and that's defining what is worthy of tax-exempt status. And we appear to be moving into an era. In fact, this president has even created his own social innovation fund, where he's actually saying that the government ought to be kind of picking some winners. And he's seeded it with money, and there's committees that are actually picking winners. These are the kinds of charities that basically the government is approving of, that's doing good social work, and the government's making gifts to them like they were a foundation.
Mm-hmm.
This is very risky to do this because what we may be moving towards is what I would describe as a charitable SEC, a governing body that ultimately will determine who gets the U.S. government's good housekeeping seal of tax-exempt status. And as you could well imagine, the last people to stand, in all likelihood, getting approval will be houses of worship,
mm-hmm.
churches, synagogues, parishes, mosques, all those. They'll be the ones that stand the longest. The first ones to go, though, will be what I call non-government replacing function organizations.
And what are those?
Well, that would be anything that doesn't replace a government function. So, for example, in our world, parachurch organizations would be out.
Mm-hmm. Give an example of something like that.
Sure. Young Life is an example.
Okay.
Certainly any organizations that don't replace government functionality that might have any political tainting to them. Organizations that what you would consider to be most any conservative Christian organization would all, in all likelihood be in that bin. But again, there would be some liberal ones as well. The catch is that most of the liberal charities are much more likely to be seen as government replacing function charities. So, for example, environmental charities will make the cut. But I think that we're moving towards that. So round one is going to be houses of worship and government replacing function charities, which our government will determine who they are. They will retain tax-exempt status. The rest of you won't. You can still give to them. They can still exist. They can still do good work. It's just you don't get a tax benefit when you give to them. We then have, so that's basically one way that this could play itself out. And there are indications that people are thinking like this in Washington already.
Now, again, you mentioned, and this I think is important to point out, that these organizations will still exist.
Yes.
But they don't get the tax-exempt status that other groups would get. Do you anticipate that many people will just flood out of giving to those organizations and into other organizations?
I anticipate that one of the reasons that the mega church is becoming a reality is because someday they're going to house dozens and dozens of community charities that lose their tax-exempt status. And those organizations are going to become a part of churches.
That's an interesting observation.
But I think that it's going to be an interesting test for believers. In other words, just how generous are you really? Are you still going to give like you've given even when you can't get a tax benefit? And we don't fully know the answer to that question.
Yeah.
Sure hope so.
Yeah. Well, this brings up another issue that I'm curious about, and we've had podcasts in the past about this. When it comes to the government deciding who is tax exempt and who isn't, the government gets a very strong hand in picking the winners and losers in many ways in the charitable organization. Now, this reminds me a great deal of what occurred under the Bush administration with the faith-based initiative. And actually, you could even take this back into the Clinton administration, his initiative on charitable choice. And the Obama administration now has picked up on the faith-based initiative. I think they call it the faith-based and community initiative
right. In
that regard. And now, in the Bush administration's faith-based initiative, there are a number of different component parts to it. One of them was to relax some of the regulatory barriers that faced a lot of these organizations. But another aspect of it, and this is the one I want to focus on, is that the government would actually give out grants to religious charitable organizations in a competitive grant funding operation. What are your thoughts on that aspect of the faith-based initiative?
Well, I think it's one of the, the bottom line is our government makes massive amounts of grants
mm-hmm.
into the exempt sector. That's a foregone conclusion, and that is going to happen. It's happened for many, many years. It will continue to happen. If we understood how much money that really was, we would all be shocked at how much money. But it's not a bad thing. So I'm pretty much for, if the government is going to be making grants, I want it to make grants to the most effective charities that it possibly can. And so I think if I'm in that position, that's what I want it to do. I understand and appreciate the fact that, nobody really wants, well, I shouldn't say nobody. Folks understand why you wouldn't want the government to be making grants to charities that are going to use those funds to go out and proselytize people into their religious belief system. That's problematic. No matter what belief system you adhere to.
Right.
But there are lots of organizations who clearly are religious in nature that do extraordinary work that isn't a proselytizing function.
Right.
So, for example, right here in Atlanta, we have an organization called the North American Mission Board, which is a part of the Southern Baptist denomination.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the largest disaster recovery organizations in the world. It's huge, and it's probably one of the most effective, from what I understand. Would it not make sense? And it was also, by the way, one of the key players in actually getting things positively done in Katrina.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't it make sense that you would rather the government make a grant to that organization to get that work done than to give a grant to FEMA to get that work done? I don't have a problem with that. Now, certainly there are risks that those organizations have. I mean, the paperwork is probably, there's no telling what kind of paperwork they have to do.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to be very careful how they do what they do. And, of course, it's not a sustainable level of funding. No organization should ever think that the government is going to provide a sustainable level of funding, because I'm telling you, it's not moving in the right direction for that to happen.
Yeah, I want to bring that up, because this is one of my concerns, too, about the government giving grants to religious charities, is that people will start to view this as a sustainable portion of their own private charity budget. And I think about this in terms of the university system, the public university system, where we count a great deal on federal grants coming into us, and
Oh, yeah. It's
always budgeted in there. And when things get tight, we tend to panic and freak out and don't know what to do. It seems to me that there's almost the possibility of becoming addicted to this granting money, and it in some ways could corrupt the organization.
You bet it can. And you better go in with eyes wide open,
right,
on that one.
My other concern, too, is about once you take a government grant, it often may have strings attached with it. And
Yep. We
had a discussion with Jay Hine earlier on this issue, and the Bush Faith-Based Initiative tried to limit these as much as possible.
Right.
But it might be moving in the opposite direction, that if you take government funding, then you're on board with the equal opportunity employment legislation that is out there. So if you're working with a Catholic charity and somebody says, well, I'm not Catholic, I'm atheist and militantly so, but you still have to hire me, that becomes a big, huge problem for that organization.
You bet it does. And those issues, you know, it's just a matter of degrees of how many strings there are and how big they are. But these charitable organizations, they need to count that cost in the process.
Yeah.
And for some, that might make sense. For others, it wouldn't make any sense at all. And they need to go in understanding that from the very outset, so that it isn't sustainable funding. Don't think it is sustainable, and don't ignore the strings that are attached.
Mm-hmm.
However, if you have a project that you're working on that has a limited life, and the strings are something you can live with, and you're the most effective charity out there getting it done, well, let's fund them.
That turns me to the last thing that I want to talk about, and we have a few minutes left here on our podcast, but we've been talking about broad philosophical issues here in our podcast, more some specific changes that are in the offing related to the tax code, but I want to pick your brain a little bit when it comes to specific hints and advice for us individuals out there in the world who want to give to charity and such. From your vantage point, having done this for over a decade and worked with donors and charitable organizations, what are some of the biggest mistakes that people make when giving to charities, and what other types of advice would you give?
Well, one of the biggest mistakes that people make when they're giving to charities is that they just don't really understand who they're giving to. It's often an extremely reactive process for folks. And again, I'm talking about people who are active in their giving. And it's so important that people understand the organizations that they're giving to. And so I encourage people, especially people that are making large gifts, that they understand who the leader of that organization is, that they understand the strategy that organization has. I encourage people, to get engaged with an organization before they make a major gift. And usually what we say is that when people are very reactive in their giving, we call it tipping, not giving, like giving a tip to a waiter or a waitress. It's a very passive, reflexive thing that, you know, you just do when you sign the bill and on your way out the restaurant. And we encourage people to get engaged with what they're giving to. And when they don't do that, they run a lot of risks. So that's one thing I would encourage people to do.
Well, that's great. We are at the end of our podcast here, and many of the changes that you've been talking about to the tax code and to the definition of charitable organizations, we're going to be keeping our eyes on. And if there are any changes to that, I think what we're going to do is give you a call back and check in with you and see how that's progressing. You'd be willing to come back on the show at some point?
Sure, absolutely. I enjoyed our time.
Well, David, thank you very much for being on Research on Religion.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.